This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this is Arizona History. Today's reading is from the book titled Tucson Memories, written by Bonnie Henry and published in 2006. This section is about hometown notables. This is article number 12, Chuck Wagon, spelled W-A-G-G-I-N. He gave us color in a black and white world. Though his given name was Charles Amsbury, every kid in town knew him as Chuck Wagon, the zany host of Cartoon Corral. He was even listed in the telephone book as Chuck Wagon, said his widow, Carol Amsbury. Back in the days when weekday afternoons belonged to the kids and nobody had heard of Oprah, Wagon ruled the Tucson airways. From the mid-1950s to 1963, he rode those waves at KVOA, doodling his way into the hearts of thousands of Tucson youngsters. He would do a cartoon. The children would copy it at home and send them in, said Carol. He would get oodles and oodles of them and bring them home. Her job was to pick a winner. Many of them were perfect, very artistic, so I would often pick other names of kids who you didn't see over and over. She also made his studio props, such as the three female dummies Wagon occasionally danced with on the air. He'd come home for lunch and say, "Well, what am I going to do today?" One day I had a wool sweater that I'd washed and shrunk. He took that and said, "I'll be a bullfighter today." Wagon was also known for the cartoon panels he drew that ran in the Arizona Sonoran Deserts Museum column by George L. Mountain Lion. The cartoons in the column were published every Sunday in the Arizona Daily Star during the 1960s. Wagon also came out with two books of his own, A Lighthearted Look at the Desert and A Lighthearted Look at the Roadrunner. He did the drawings. Carol supplied the prose and the poetry. The Northwest Side home where she and Wagon moved to more than 40 years ago would soon be filled with his artwork. "He just loved art," said Carol. He also loved her. "We knew each other since junior high," said Carol, who, like her husband, grew up in Berkeley, California. By the time he was 6, he was winning art contests. But when Wagon graduated from high school in 1933, it was the belly of the Great Depression. So he went to work driving a truck. When he hit the watershed mark of $50 a week in 1938, they married and raised a son. During the war, Wagon found work in the California shipyards. After the war, he went to work for Sears, unloading freight. In 1952, he moved to Phoenix at the urging of his brother-in-law. There, Carol said, he was told, "You know, there's a new thing here, a television station." Soon, he was churning out drawings for commercials and station breaks at the station's first television station. A year later, he came to Tucson and went to work for brand new KVOA, Channel 4. "The station staff consisted of me and the man who was building the station," Wagon told the Star in 1982. Cartoon Corral headed for its last roundup in 1963 after the Huntley-Brinkley report took its time slot, said Carol. But her husband stayed on as the station's art director. In 1982, Wagon retired. But he continued to photograph and make slideshows of desert critters scurrying through his yard. He called it an acre of nature, said Carol. Bone cancer took his life in 1993. "He was such an amusing man," said Carol, shaking her head. "I had a laugh a day with that man." Didn't we all? This next section is entitled War and Disasters. The first article, Train Wreck of 1903. What a fearsome sound it must have made rolling out across the desert. On January 28, 1903, two passenger trains collided head-on, east of Tucson, in the heart of what we now call Rita Ranch. 14 people died on the spot, their bodies mangled and burned almost beyond recognition. So great was the force of the 2:55 a.m. collision that the Pullman car at the rear of the eastbound train was jarred loose, rolling 14 miles down the track into the Tucson train yard it had left just minutes before. Its sole passenger, a Pullman porter, emerged shocked but unscathed, bearing witness to the horrors ahead on the track. About the same time, a brakeman on that same eastbound train managed to hike several miles from the wreck to the Vail station to wire for help. Doctors on board a relief train from Tucson rushed to the scene. The undertakers and reporters soon followed. Undertakers Parker and Riley have 14 bodies, reported the next day's Star, which described the condition of the bodies in gruesome detail. The wreck itself, reported the Star, presented a scene never to be forgotten. The two monster engines were literally torn to pieces and the cars piled on top of each other, enveloped in sheets of flames and clouds of smoke. The injured, at least 18 in number, were hauled back to town for treatment. Meanwhile, coffins lined the wreckage, waiting to be filled. Among the reported dead, the engineers from both trains, a fireman, and several passengers, including a millionaire capitalist. Three of the dead were listed as hobos, including one, reported the Tucson Citizen, who was riding the brakes and was pinioned by the collision. He was burned to a cinder. It was one of the deadliest train wrecks in Arizona, and certainly the worst involving the Southern Pacific Line in southern Arizona, said Tucson historian and writer William Colt, author of Tucson Was a Railroad Town. Naturally, it was attributed to human error, with most fingers pointed towards E.F. Clow, night operator at Vail. At 2:40 a.m., just minutes before the crash, a westbound passenger train, with engineer Jack Bruce at the throttle, pulled into the Vail station. There, Clow was supposed to pass off two written orders to train conductor G.W. Parker. One of the orders, sent minutes earlier from Tucson, was to sidetrack the train at the Esmond siding, 4 miles down the track, until an eastbound train passed through. Parker testified that he never got that order. Though initial reports cast some blame on the conductor, subsequent coroner's juries exonerated Parker and found Clow at fault. Just before the crash, Clow, realizing this crucial order may not have been received, wired the Tucson office. But it was too late. 5 minutes later, Clow wired back that there was a large sheet of flame ahead on the track. By the time of the inquest, Clow had disappeared. Parker was later fired by SP, but found work at another railroad, said Colt. While the train tracks were eventually moved to the west, the ruins of the Esmond station, built close to that fateful siding, would stand for another century. On November 27, 2003, the station burned to the ground. But you can still see remnants of the old train bed running near the busy intersection of Rita and Houghton Roads. On the intersection's northwest corner, a Fry's grocery store sprawls right over the crash site. Article number 2, Armistice Day. There will be a parade on Veterans Day, perhaps a concert or two. Schools and government offices will be closed. And don't forget that huge two-for-one sale of one kind or another down at the mall. Veterans Day wasn't always done that way, let alone named that way. Armistice Day was what we once called it, marking the end of the war that engulfed Europe in 1914 and, 3 years later, America. It all ended on November 11, 1918. The war to end all wars, or so we thought. Southern Arizona sent its first men to that war on September 9, 1917, seen off by 2,000 flag-waving well-wishers. 13 months later, Tucsonians were giddily awaiting the end of the war. Not knowing exactly when the armistice would be signed, city movers and shakers, reported the Star, agreed that the celebration would and could only be spontaneous. Some advertisers lost no time in jumping on the peace bandwagon. "Germany is coming to her senses," crowd an ad for the New York store on West Congress Street. Yet others had failed to get the message. "Use more eggs to save meat," ran an ad for, of all things, Lucky Strike cigarettes. "World freed of Hun menace" was bannered across the next day's paper, along with stories of wild scenes of joy across America. If Tucson experienced wild scenes of joy, it was not to be found in the Star. What was reported was that food prices were still expected to remain artificially high. But there was good news as well. The draft was canceled. Even better, baseball would return to a full schedule the following spring. Still, much remained to be done. An editorial in the Star exhorted Tucsonians to remember the countries that are looking to America to be fed and clothed. The Star also got behind a back-to-school campaign sponsored by the U.S. Department of Labor. The drive was to counteract the wage dazzle that had lured boys and girls away from school during the war and into jobs with little promise. A year later, President Woodrow Wilson proclaimed November 11th as Armistice Day. New Yorkers, it was reported, celebrated with prohibition booze made from hair tonic and prune juice. Meanwhile, merrymakers in Tucson lived it up at an armistice dance at the Armory. The University of Arizona held a rousing patriotic assembly in the auditorium. After the faculty declared the rest of the day a holiday, students, the UA band, assorted veterans, and a squad of young ladies who carried the flag marched from the campus to downtown. It might also be noted that several merchants, including Myers and Bloom and Tucson Meat and Provision, closed for the day. The families of 42 young men from southern Arizona probably did little celebrating that day. Their boys never returned. The same could be said for another 116,666 Americans killed in what was then called the Great War. No one, after all, could imagine a successor. "The world slept better last night for the first time in 4 years," were the words in a Star editorial published the day after the armistice was signed. Unlike anything of its kind in history, the ending of the Great War was celebrated throughout the world. In all probability, no such spontaneous outburst of thankfulness, joy, enthusiasm, and patriotism will ever be shown again in this or any other country. Wild celebrations marking the end of World War II were a mere 27 years away. Article number 3, under Wars and Disasters. Tucson High, Class of 42. The dress was formal, the occasion the senior prom, and the night the last of carefree innocence the Class of 42 would ever know. Saturday, December 6th, 1941. More than 100 couples swirl and sway across the floor of the Tucson High School cafeteria, transformed for one night and one night only into a snowland wonderland. Never again would a group of Tucson teenagers be caught so clearly in the crosshairs of world events. "In the middle of our senior year, we were faced with decisions that would affect our future forever," said Catherine Reese Hollinger, member of the first THS class to graduate under the pall of World War II. As high school classes go, it would turn out to be a fairly distinguished lot. Among its ranks, a future Tucson mayor and Pima County supervisor, as well as doctors, lawyers, artists, and at least one almost Brooklyn Dodger. But the glue that would bind these men and women together for years to come was more than mere nostalgia. It was the stuff of war and loss and sacrifice, and of coming of age much too soon, and much too young. I remember hearing about Pearl Harbor from the family radio, said Halsinger. I started to cry. Others took the news with considerably more nonchalance. I don't remember hearing about it on the radio, said June Holmes Vance, who had attended the prom the night before. I was probably sleeping. Bud Granger was goofing around in the backyard when his dad came out and delivered the news. I thought, I guess that will shoot my baseball career, said Granger, who had signed a contract to play ball for the Brooklyn Dodgers farm team, the Olin Oilers. For many, the significance of it all would only begin to seep in the following morning at school. I was in band, said Ivan Hawkins, first trumpet. That Monday morning, Professor Sewell, Arthur Sewell, he was the head of the bands and orchestra, asked us all to stand up. Then the band hit the Star Spangled Banner. I'll always remember that. And then, at mid-morning, the sonorous tones of Franklin D. Roosevelt began to echo through the school's public address system. It was the president declaring war, said Tom Moore. First to heed the call from the class of 42 were a handful of students who belonged to the National Guard. When the National Guard was activated, we had a school assembly, said Halsinger. Those kids that were going went up on the stage in uniform. They had a ceremony and called their names off one by one as they left. And then they were gone. Moore quickly followed. You'd be sitting next to someone in class, and before the end of the school year, he was gone, said Moore, who wound up flying combat missions over Japan during the last months of the war. All through the late winter and early spring of 42, the Japanese swaggered through one conquest after another, Manila, Singapore, Bataan, Korogut. But for the class of 42, this was also the last spring they'd ever spend in high school. Which meant there was basketball to be played, dances to attend, plays to rehearse, and burgers and frosted root beers to be quaffed at the old Red and Blue drive-in. We were doing all the things we'd always done, said Moore. Why not? No one could deny, however, that this year's graduation was different. I remember a lot of the guys were already gone, said June Holmes Vance. They left their seats empty. I remember looking down the rows of seats and seeing those empty chairs. Graduation was very quiet, said Holsinger. On that last day of school, we just knew we were leaving our whole future behind us, or at least the remnants of childhood. Right after graduation, Lou Donahue marched into the American Legion Hall to take his Army physical. But a missing left thumb quickly stuck with him, a F4 label. I was shocked, said Donahue, already a crack shot and member of the National Rifle Association. I wasn't very happy at all. Meanwhile, Bud Granger, who had graduated mid-year in January of 42, decided to stick to his dreams of glory with the Dodgers. They offered me $75 a month, said Granger, who only lasted a couple of months with the Dodgers Class D team in Olin, New York. By May of 42, he was back in Tucson. By February of 43, he was in a Marine uniform. The co-eds of the Class of 42 also did their part for the war effort. As soon as she turned 20, the minimum age with a parent's permission, Martha Dadsman, manager, signed up with the SPARS, S-P-A-R-S, the female branch of the U.S. Coast Guard. It would be 1946 before she would return to Tucson. My joke was that my mother signed me to go in the SPAR so she could rent out my room, said manager. Halsinger sewed stomach bandages for the troops at the old Steinfeld Mansion, which was turned over to the Red Cross during the war. Alice Tully Razek picked cotton. I was working at Safeway as a cashier, said Razek. They were closed on Sundays. They asked if any of us would like to go out to pick cotton in Marana. We went out there in trucks. I had never seen a cotton field in my life. Dina Panis Kwaktik, whose parents ran the Grand Cafe at the corner of Broadway and 6th Avenue, wound up feeding soldiers, thousands of them. Our restaurant was 3 blocks from the railroad station, said Kwatek. The government contracted with us to feed the troop trains. Whenever the troops came in, we were given 1 hour's notice. They came in hungry. Romance also loomed for the class of 42, which quickly found out that while war may be hell, it's also quite an aphrodisiac. In August, Catherine Reese Hollisinger went on a blind date with a soldier. By October, she was married. It was my first and last blind date, said Hollisinger, who promptly dropped out of classes at the University of Arizona. Classmates Loretta Graydon and John Sandy McLeod began corresponding after Sandy joined the Army. Every chance I'd come back, he said. In May of 46, they were married. Not all the letters that circulated among the class of 42 were so pleasant. More than half a century later, many still remembered how they learned the deaths of classmates. Bud Granger lost 2 close friends, Frank Kemp and Cornelius Corky Moore. There were 4 of us, said Granger. Frank, Corky, Arnold Chapo, Rizinjo, and myself. We grew up together. If you saw one of us, you saw us all. Corky was killed in Iwo Jima, Frank in Germany. It was devastating, said Granger. June Holmes Vance, who had slept through the frantic radio bulletins about Pearl Harbor, lost her sweetheart to a sniper's bullet. He was killed in action in 1944 on an island in the Pacific, said Vance. Notification was her last letter to the young man, returned unopened. On the outside, they had marked with big printing, KIA. That's how I found out. After the war, June and Richard Rusty Vance, another Tucson High student who'd gone off to the war, rekindled their friendship. They were married in 1948. Tom Moore became a vice president with the Sunt Corporation. Bud Granger married the girl he met at Olin, New York, back during his Dodger tryouts. I didn't strike out with her, he said. Granger, who retired as a bank vice president, played semi-pro ball and umpired games all around southern Arizona. Many from the class of 42 went back to school on the GI Bill. Ivan Hawkins, the boy who played the Star-Spangled Banner on the morning after Pearl Harbor, went from the U.S. Army Air Forces to the University of Arizona, courtesy of Uncle Sam. The war did change our lives, said Hawkins, who had become an attorney. I don't think I would have gone to college without the GI Bill. On the other hand, Catherine Hollisinger said the war probably kept her from getting her college diploma. If there had been no war, I would not have met and married a soldier. I would have probably completed college. The class of 42 would become filled with grand grandparents. 13 of its number, however, will remain forever locked into the memory of youth. They were the ones killed in action, in a war that began just hours past their last senior dance. Bear Down, Arizona, Louis Lower Level. If anything on campus shouted, "Hey kid, you're not in high school anymore," this was the place. Not a window anywhere. Hamburger sizzling all hours of the day and night, and half the diners with a cigarette in their hands. This was Louis Lower Level, at least in the days before smoking was banned. When the popular eatery in the basement of the University of Arizona Student Union closed after a grease fire in 2000, Louis was still dishing the chow. But even before the fire, its days were numbered. Ah, well, Louis had already made an indelible mark in the memories, not to mention the cholesterol counts, of thousands of Wildcats. When the student union opened in 1951, there was no Louis, only a basement area with dirt floor and unfinished ceiling. A year or so later, students turned it into a meeting and party place, complete with sawdust over the dirt and portable lighting. So who, everyone wants to know, was Louis? It came from a kid on the student activities board, said Bill Varney, student union director from 1958 to 1984. He said, "This is just like a place in Chicago, where you went down the stairs and there was a sawdust on the floor. It was called Louis's Lower Level. The name stuck, said Varney, who came by that story from his predecessor, the late Marvin Swede Johnson. In November of 1957, Louis's opened as an ultra-modern cafeteria lounge, complete with card-playing section, television, and pastel-colored booths. Jack Redhair, then student body president, was among the first to partake at Louis's menu, which included everything from pizza to salads. He remembered burgers for breakfast and a jukebox that cranked out the hits, 3 for a quarter. The place was jumping 7 days a week, said Varney. Kids studied there, read their mail there, met their future wives there. Perhaps the grandest entrance anyone ever made at Louis's belonged to Redhair's wife, the former Diane Vance. Back then, a UA publication called Arizona Kitty Cat had a little feature called Kitten of the Month. In March of 1958, Diane Vance won the honor. The publication also sponsored a date with Diane, which turned into several dates, including one at Louis's. They flew me in a helicopter, and I landed on the girls' athletic field, said Diane Redhair, who then proceeded to Louis's. The times, they kept on a-changin'. November 22, 1963, the day President Kennedy was shot. Service canceled in Louis's as crowd huddles before TV, read the headline in that day's Wildcat. Kids were still watching TV at Louis's a decade later. In fact, when the grill caught fire in 1973, some had to be pulled away from their favorite soaps. In 1993, there was a brief push to shut down Louis's in favor of name-brand franchises. Never happened. Costs were too high. But eventually, it all came to an end. Thanks for a great run, Louis, whoever you are. This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.